The UN says that humanity stands on the brink of catastrophic man-made climate change. But is it true?
Not a chance. But we do stand on the brink of catastrophic government policies that threaten to ruin the nation our forefathers built and defended against tyranny.
So what drives the climate scare, Jay?
Besides simple ignorance, the scare is driven by corporate greed and the desire of government to control all aspects of our lives, Tom.
Is this part of something more sinister?
Indeed it is. Whether it's climate change or a pandemic or socialism, it really means sacrificing your rights and accepting the tyranny of the fourth branch of government, the bureaucracy. It must be stopped.
This is The Other Side of the Story with Dr. Jay Lair and Tom Harris of the International Climate Science Coalition.
Our guest today is Dr. Kelvin Kemm, a business strategy consultant who runs his own company, Strattech, based in Pretoria, South Africa. Dr. Kemm is a nuclear physicist and is past chairman of the South African Nuclear Energy Corporation, or NECSA. On completion of his PhD from the University of KwaZulu-Natal, he started work as a research and development scientist at NECSA. He then moved into the management of technology and became involved in a wide variety of projects in many industrial sectors. Dr. Kemm developed high technology systems and frequently went out in the field to work on developments firsthand. These activities took him into many factories, down mines, into power stations, riding and experimental aircraft and vehicles, and into banking, advertising, and marketing systems. Dr. Kemm also regularly lectures at a variety of institutions, ranging from schools to the Defense College, and has appeared on radio and TV programs in South Africa and overseas, and is often a speaker at public events. Kelvin has written over 1,000 popular interest articles in journals, magazines, and newspapers, and has written 2 books, links to which we will include when this program goes to podcast on Monday this coming week. He has been a guest speaker in places as diverse as Hanoi, Windhoek in Namibia, Stockholm, and even at tribal events in the bush. He's also given Senate and congressional briefings in Washington, D.C. In 2003, Dr. Kemm was awarded the Lifetime Achievers Award in Science and Technology by the National Science and Technology Forum. So we're certainly very fortunate to have him on the show today. So welcome to the program, Dr. Kemm.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be talking to you fellows.
Yeah, so you're just starting your spring, I guess, is coming up in South Africa.
Absolutely. The buds are all coming out on the plants, and soon the flowers will start to appear, but it suddenly erupts here out of the dryness. Everything that was brown suddenly turns green. It's quite different to spring erupting in a country that's generally quite wet.
Yeah, well, that sounds really quite beautiful. So when we talk nuclear physics to most people, their eyes will glaze over with either a lack of understanding or a fear of the unknown. So, Dr. Kemm, can you start by describing how a nuclear reactor works and why it's such a valuable energy source?
Absolutely. I'd be pleased to do that because, as you say, people's eyes glaze over and they really don't know, or they have heard about the bombing of Hiroshima or something and there's immediately a negative reaction. Now, normally with a chemical reaction like burning coal or burning paper or wood, what happens is that molecules connect up with oxygen and there's a molecular reaction between the two and a bit of energy comes off as the carbon and the oxygen join up. And there's an amount, if you stick your hand on a fire, you'll know all about it. Now, in the case of nuclear, you go deeper beyond the outer electrons of the molecule and you get down into the nucleus of the atom. The forces that hold the nucleus together are very, very powerful. Millions and millions of times more powerful than the chemical forces on the outside of the atom. It was found just over a century ago now that if you split a uranium nucleus, some energy comes out. In fact, a huge amount of energy. At the time, the people didn't realize just how dramatic this would be because it was all done so small in laboratories. But today we know that if you take uranium atoms, split them in half, as they break in half, they reform into two balls again, and out comes dramatic energy of million times more than coal, for example. And it's the control of that energy which gives you such an amazing amount of power out of a very, very small volume of uranium.
Mm-hmm. Now, what would you say are the best applications for nuclear power?
Well, just about everything that needs electricity and many more. Here in South Africa, we have a nuclear power station that's been running successfully for many years. But we also, for example, produce nuclear medicine. We produce nuclear medicine every single day of the year, and it's distributed all over the world. We're the world's second biggest producer of nuclear medicine, and there are two or three exports per day that take place. So nuclear is not just a case of using it to make electricity. You can use it in medicine to detect cancer, for example, and to treat certain cancers. You can also use it in agriculture, in soils, to trace certain chemicals. You can trace water currents. You can trace air currents. There's all sorts of things that can be done with nuclear that the people generally don't know about. And you find it all around you all of the time, and mostly when it's around you, people don't even know it's there.
Kelvin, it's interesting. Next week, we're interviewing scientist Ed Calabrese, that has been leading a battle for 40 years to make more nuclear medicine available by getting rid of the linear no threshold theory that the government holds, that a single molecule or atom of radiation can lead to cancer. It's been proven over and over again that that is not true, and that small amounts of radiation are very helpful in medicine, as you've described. And unfortunately, the government blocks more and more of it that is so very useful. And it's wonderful that that's one of the major things that you're doing in South Africa. But I have a question. Many people feel that ultimately, long range in some number of centuries, carbon-based fuel like natural gas and coal and oil will be exhausted, and that the world will run on nuclear power. Why is it that people feel that the resource of uranium that creates nuclear power, and I'll just go a step further there and say that basically it creates heat, and the heat is used to heat water, which turns to steam, and steam turns a turbine. I like to say it's not rocket science. Actually, understanding how a nuclear power plant works is not as complicated as people think. But why is it felt that our resource of uranium to run nuclear power plants is essentially not even exhaustible?
Well, you know, one factor with uranium is that you need so little of it. Tiny amount of uranium has got so much energy in it. Now, I've got no doubt in my own mind that in half a century's time, and certainly a century's time and so on, the world will run entirely on nuclear. People will look back with amusement at the year 2000 and that period in history when there was doubt about it. It's just like we look back at amusement now that there were horse-drawn carts being pulled through London and New York and so on at some stage, and then these newfangled motor cars came about, and people said, that will never last. And wooden sailing ships, and then steamships came about, metal steamships, and people said, oh, that metal steamships is a passing fad. They will stick with the wooden sailing ships, and they didn't. We think it's funny now. We're in exactly that same phase now, moving into the nuclear future of mankind, and people have got to somehow understand that we're going there. And it's just a case of how fast we go there. So I believe that in due course, the fossil fuels will fade away by themselves because nuclear will just take over. And it's undoubtedly the best energy form for a whole lot of reasons.
Mm-hmm. So what fraction of the world's electricity currently comes from nuclear power?
Well, it's about 10, 11% or something like that. it's varied a bit, and it also depends on which country you look at. If you look at France, for example, France is some 70% nuclear. Back in 1974, I think it was, if I remember, the oil crisis that occurred at the time gave them such a fright that they said, let's not find ourselves over a barrel again, excuse the pun, to find ourselves worrying about where electricity is coming from. So they took the decision then to go nuclear. To my mind, it's turned out to be the right decision. Mm-hmm. Other people haven't done that. But there's a classic example there now, France, 70% nuclear. Other countries are 5 or 6% nuclear. South Africa is in that position, 5 or 6 nuclear now. Others are 20, 30% like Sweden. So it varies quite a bit. But there's significant nuclear around the world, some 400 nuclear power stations now around the world producing electricity. We should be much further ahead.
Well, the United States once led at one time. We had 104 nuclear plants operating. Now we're probably down to 90 as a dozen or so have been recommissioned. But we haven't built a new plant since 1978, I believe. There are two plants being built in the state of Georgia. I doubt they'll ever be completed because their costs have skyrocketed because people don't understand the actual safety of nuclear power plants. And the constructor are forced to build in safety mechanisms and protocols that are absolutely unnecessary. I know for sure you could drive a very large commercial jet plane into any of our nuclear power stations, and while it might shut off the power, it wouldn't release radiation that would cause a problem. But it seems that around the world, there are a couple hundred power stations being built. Why is the rest of the world doing a better job today than the United States? And of course, how specifically is South Africa increasing right now?
Well, I think that's a very good point that you've raised there about the safety. Currently, nuclear is the safest electricity source by far. You know, if you look at the death rate in nuclear, for example, there's less people being killed in nuclear than solar, wind, hydro, any of those. So nuclear is incredibly safe. My belief is that in 1945, when the nuclear bomb was dropped on Hiroshima at the time, that was the birth of nuclear as far as public opinion was concerned. So people got such a fright at that. Then the threat that came about during the 1960s when the then Soviet Union and the United States were eyeing each other and building up nuclear weapons, this fear of nuclear came about that is now a paranoia with so many people. And as a result, nuclear has had an incredibly important role to play in safety. There's been a safety consciousness which is way above anything else. And as you correctly said, in nuclear now, when anything is built, there's huge safety protocols. Quite frankly, it's sort of gone too far because people always fear that something could go wrong. And obviously the potential is there, but so can that happen with the wind turbine and many other things. Now, at the moment, you'll find certain countries like the US and all European countries, there's an obsession now with not having nuclear, not having coal and so on. It's driven by a lot of anti-nuclear sentiment coming out of anti-nuclear organizations. And I think that's very wrong. In contrast, the Chinese, the Russians, Koreans, a number of people in the Middle East and that now, the UAE and so on, have realized that nuclear is the future and they don't have the same level of fear amongst their population. So the nuclear balance in that sense is now changing. Russians are building nuclear power plants, the Chinese are building nuclear power plants, and so you'll find that the expertise is building up, whereas it's been going down in the UK, down in France, and of course very much down in the US. And it's a pity. We need correct public education. People must understand. They must see new pictures in their mind. They mustn't always have the bomb blasts and all sorts of other stuff. And this LNT that was mentioned earlier, the theory that says that there's no lower threshold below which nuclear is safe. That's just wrong. Nuclear is not only safe below a certain threshold, but beneficial with nuclear medicine. So this huge fear of nuclear is just unfounded. And the public really need to see that for what it is and not listen to so many of these extreme anti-nuclear groups that have another agenda, which to my mind is such a pity. It just pushes the price of electricity up for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Because we're always subjected to some form of natural radiation, aren't we?
Absolutely, yes. Bananas, for example, are quite radioactive. So is the granite tops that you get in kitchens. Here in South Africa, having granite kitchen tops is quite common. They consider it quite a luxurious item. I don't know if it's the same in the US. But granite has got uranium in it naturally, so it's quite active. So if you've got a bowl of bananas on a granite top, that's quite active. If that was actually, if that was something coming out of a nuclear power plant, the detectors would detect it and condemn it as too radioactive to leave the plant. It would have to be routed down to a nuclear waste storage system. But you can have them in your house. Detectors as well. They've got nuclear source and the smoke detectors. That's how they work. So it's all around us. So this unreasonable fear of radiation is just wrong. It's not.
I want to repeat that, Dr. Kim, for the audience, what you said, that a bowl of bananas sitting on a granite countertop in a kitchen would give off enough radiation that they wouldn't allow it coming from a nuclear power plant. It is ridiculous. Radiation is around all of us. If you live in Denver, Colorado, you get a huge amount of radiation. And in no way does it have a negative impact on human health. And we've got to drive that home over and over again. Why is it that this fear is waning in other countries while not as much here in the United States? Why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's a deliberate thing that's being done by anti-nuclear groups. And sadly, what seems to be happening is that certain anti-nuclear groups are actually anti-electricity. They don't want more electricity. So they're looking to stop the production of large amounts of electricity. So it's no longer about nuclear itself. I've been in debates with some of these extremists from Europe. And they say, we've got to look after the planet, we've got to save the planet. Of course we have to look after the planet. If you want to see beautiful nature, come here to South Africa where you can walk in the bush, not that far from my house. You can walk and there's giraffes and zebras and kudu and all sorts of buck walking around wild. A little bit further, there are lions and things like that. So if you want to see wild nature, come here. So of course you must look after the planet. But this wrong belief that we're in a crisis situation right now, so that they don't want any expansion of industry. If you look at the sites of certain of these organizations like Greenpeace and so on the internet, they say there, let us try and stop GDP growth. People don't understand that this is a motivation. The way to stop GDP growth, stop building more factories, stop making air conditioners, stop this, stop that, stop all of industrial expansion. And to stop that, you want to stop the electricity supply. And it sounds crazy, but this is what's happening. I've sat with green extremists from Europe who've told me they want Africa to be effectively frozen where it is now. I had a Swiss fellow sitting with Germans and French, and he said to my face, Africa can be allowed to expand its electricity by about 10%, then it must be blocked. We don't want Africans driving more motor cars. We don't want them building more factories. We don't want air conditioning. We don't want this. They must not follow the bad example of Switzerland, he said to me, where we've gone too far. What an unbelievable cheek that somebody from Switzerland can tell me that people in my part of the world are not allowed to build factories and more motor cars because they will produce exhaust smoke. They'll use more diesel. There'll be more vehicles on the road, which is generally bad for the planet. You can't do that. So then they say, we can't use fossil fuels. And all right, you can't use fossil fuels because by their argument, there's carbon dioxide that comes off. Then you say, well, nuclear is the answer. Nuclear doesn't have carbon dioxide. Oh, dear, they say in their closed rooms. We can't let them have nuclear either because then they'll get more electricity. So now they've got to think up reasons to be anti-nuclear. And that's what's happening in the United States. At times we sit here and we think it's quite funny, some of the ridiculous things that come out of the US. We see the same coming out of Europe as well. But you look towards Russia, you look towards China, they say, let's build our economy. Building the economy everybody gets better off and people don't burn rubbish and that to make heat, they'll use electricity. So you have overall a better planet, a better life, a better everything if there's more electricity. Mm-hmm. And so that's what's happening. There's much more to this than meets the eye if you dig into it a bit.
You know, one of the environmentalists in Canada, David Suzuki, I remember years ago when he was on television condemning nuclear power. And as he was speaking, there were hydrogen bombs going off behind him on the screen. Now, that's a connection that isn't really valid, is it?
Absolutely not. It's not that difficult to actually make a nuclear weapon, a nuclear bomb. The real difficult part is the enrichment of uranium. Normal uranium, natural uranium, when it comes out of the ground, is 99.3% of one of the isotopes you don't want. The isotope that fissions easily is only 0.7%. On its own, in Canada, they've made a reactor called CANDU, which uses that type of uranium. But generally speaking, you want to enrich it, which means throwing away some of the uranium atoms you don't want, the 238 isotope, and keeping the 235 isotope. So then the percentage goes up. For a normal day-to-day, if I can put it that way, nuclear power plant, you want an enrichment of about 5%. In other words, about 5% must be the 235 atoms. The modern small modular reactors go up as far as 10%. But to make a good nuclear bomb that goes bang nicely, you need better than 90%. It's a completely different ballgame. There's no ways that a nuclear reactor can explode like a bomb. It just can't happen. Mm-hmm. In fact, just a few years ago, the international community got together, the nuclear community, and had a chat about all of this, and they decided to make a line of 20%. That was a political type decision, so to speak. They said anybody working with enrichments under 20% are considered to be in the safe zone. That's the power zone, nuclear medicine zone, and so on. When you start to dabble above the 20% mark, there's no need to be there unless you're heading towards weapons. So there's an agreement now that 20% is the barrier. Don't go above 20%. If you do, you're heading towards weapons territory. So there's no connection between nuclear weapons and nuclear power plants on condition that you obey the rules and you're a responsible country and you do everything correctly. And that, of course, is very important.
Well, this is one of the way that we watched Iran and North Korea refining the uranium. And we knew when they were moving up well past 20%, trying to get to 90%, that they were intending to make bombs. So this has been one of the ways that we've been able to understand what they were up to. And what you say is there's really no chance in general nuclear power and nuclear medicine of creating anything that's dangerous. And that's been something we have to make clear to the public. And revisiting something you said earlier, wind and solar are far more hazardous and dangerous in terms of human health than is nuclear. I mean, in the mining of all the materials that it takes to make a wind turbine or to make solar farms, more people die by far than in all the nuclear power plants in the world. So all manufacturing, all mining has a hazard to it. And nuclear, as you said, is the least hazardous of all the forms of energy there are.
Absolutely. It's very much the case. And in the case of wind and solar, it's not just the manufacturing and the mining, it's the actual devices themselves. There's just a few days ago, I watched a really unpleasant video clip of two fellows, in fact, in the United States, who were at the top of one of these wind turbines servicing it, and it caught fire. And it caught fire where the ladder was to get out. And they couldn't get out. And there you see the turbine actually catching fire and the two individuals standing on the top. They had the choice of standing there and burning to death or jumping off. The one fellow burnt to death and the other one jumped to his death. So those are actual deaths from wind energy. Now, in the case of nuclear power, other than the Chernobyl incident that happened in the former Soviet Union, there's not one single individual in the world who's ever died from nuclear radiation and nuclear power, not one. not even at the infamous Fukushima incident. You know, I find myself regularly getting involved in discussions with this. I wrote an article a few years ago, which was published in Washington, D.C., and then spread all over the place on the Fukushima incident. And normally you leave it up to the editor. It's editor's prerogative to choose a title. And the editor in Washington chose the title something to the effect Fukushima was not a nuclear accident. And gee whiz, did that start a fight? And it's still to this day, people still quote it. But in fact, Fukushima was not a nuclear accident. It was a conventional industrial accident.
This happened to me, Kelvin. I had just written a book on nuclear energy that came out right around Fukushima, I believe, November 2011. And as a result of the networks finding my book, I did 23 network television shows explaining that there was nothing to fear from nuclear radiation due to the tsunami that destroyed a few of the nuclear power plants there. And yes. Kelvin, I got hate mail for 3 years for being on these shows and trying to eliminate the fear of nuclear radiation from that accident.
Yes, well, at Fukushima, not one single person died from nuclear radiation. Not one single person was harmed by nuclear radiation, and no private property was harmed by nuclear radiation. The reactors were wrecked. They were a write-off. It was a financial disaster for the owners and highly embarrassing for the Japanese government, but it wasn't nuclear. You know, if the airport catches fire and there's huge destruction at the airport, you don't call it an aircraft disaster. It's a disaster at the airport. Mm-hmm. You know, at Fukushima, it was an industrial disaster, just like if the oil refinery down the coast caught fire, which it did, and anything else, but it isn't nuclear. And these stories about all the radiation coming out of Fukushima are highly exaggerated, because something that's important to note is that there's incredibly sensitive radiation detectors that exist these days. You can detect the most minute little bit. If you take a radioactive piece of metal as big as the head of a pin and you drop it in the grass outside and you go out with a Geiger counter and walk around, you'll find it. It's not like if you have a piece of arsenic and you drop it out in the grass, it'll be a huge battle to find the arsenic. But the radiation actually sends out a signal saying, here I am. It's like a cricket in the grass. If you go out at night and you hear squeak, 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 you can find one little cricket just by listening very carefully. It's the same with radiation. And because the radiation detectors are so good, you can pick up the tiniest amount of radiation from Fukushima, for example, many kilometers away. But it doesn't mean it's dangerous. And that is part of the problem, that people say, look, we can detect the radiation 100 kilometers, 500 kilometers away from Fukushima. Yes, you can. Here in Pretoria, where I am, in South Africa, which is very far from China, years ago when the Chinese were doing nuclear bomb tests, when the Chinese detonated a nuclear bomb, about 3 days later, we were able to detect the radiation coming over Pretoria from the Chinese nuclear weapons tests. Doesn't mean that you run and dive into your house and close the door and panic. It's just that the detection equipment is so incredibly accurate that you can find it. And that's part of the problem, like with that LNT mentioned earlier. Somebody comes along and says, they found one radioactive atom in your house. Now you've got to panic. John says, no, you don't. If you eat a banana, you get much more than that. If you fly in an aeroplane, you mentioned earlier Denver. I'm in Pretoria. 60 kilometers away is Johannesburg, which is one of the highest cities in the world. Johannesburg is 6,000 feet altitude. It too, between Pretoria and Johannesburg, we're much higher up, much less air above us, so there's much less screening. So there's much higher radiation background naturally here than in coastal cities. And so, you know, if you hold a Geiger counter and just hold it outdoors, it purrs away with the amount of radiation coming down. So it's just not true that a little bit of radiation is so deadly. Obviously, a lot of radiation is. I'm not saying radiation isn't, but you've got to be able to distinguish between what's a serious amount that you have to worry about and what's a trivial amount that does not matter.
Well, we have to go to break now for a commercial. And what we'd like to deal with when we get back, not only are the situation in South Africa with regards to nuclear power, but also, Kelvin, can we step back and talk about the kinds of radiation that are produced? Because I think people get the impression that high-level waste is dangerous for millions of years, but Of course, I don't think that's true. So we'll go to break now and stay tuned. We'll be back shortly.
You know, Healthy Cell is a terrific lineup of products. They have products that are pill-free, gel-pack vitamins. Looking for better sleep, focus, and energy? Check out Healthy Cell, the leading innovator in nutritional supplements for cell health. Are you tired of being tired? Healthy Cell has a product that helps REM sleep, helps you fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cell's REM sleep supplement. The only sleep supplement that's designed to support all stages of sleep. And boy, is it needed now during all the stress of the COVID-19 pandemic. So go to healthycell.com and use the code OUTLOUD, all capital letters, OUTLOUD, for a 20% off your first order of any product from Healthy Cell. I use them every day. I believe in them, and you should too. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep can be infuriating. Your mind races. You toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's digital age makes it even harder. You're not alone with this struggle. Poor sleep affects over 70% of Americans. Even the Centers for Disease Control label insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. To take back your sleep, Healthy Cell has created REM Sleep, the only sleep supplement made to support all four stages of human sleep with calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support, delivered in a patent-pending, pill-free, ultra-absorption microgel formula that tastes great. Fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cell's REM Sleep. Go to healthycell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order. That's healthycell.com, HEALTHYCELL, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Today, America stands at the crossroads of history. Our actions will determine the fate of our nation. Well, that journey starts here and starts now. We invite you to join us in making the ultimate difference. Subscribe to our podcast and newsletters. Turn notifications on and stay in the know. You'll find all that back at AmericaOutLoud.com. Liberty and justice for all.
So, Dr. Kem, can you tell us about the different types of radiation that come from nuclear reactors? Because some activists think that high-level waste is dangerous for millions of years, but I don't think that's really true, is it?
Yes, it's radioactive for very many years, but as you say, there's different types. There's a number of different types of radiation, but the three primary ones are called alpha, beta, gamma from the Greek alphabet. Alpha is the helium nucleus. It's very big and heavy, and alpha radiation, if it hits your shirt, it probably won't go through. It'll be stopped by a sheet of paper or something as thin as that, very short range. Mm-hmm. Beta radiation is very fast-moving electrons. They will go through your shirt and a little bit into your skin, but they won't go much deeper than a little bit. They'll be stopped by your wallet in your pocket. The gamma radiation is like radio waves. It's like the microwaves in a microwave. That will go clean through you, through the wall, and out the other side of the house. That is the penetrating radiation. And each of them has their dangers and they have their uses. But there's absolutely no doubt that nuclear radiation is very dangerous when there's a lot of it and if you do something stupid. An artillery shell used by the army is incredibly dangerous if you do something silly. If you come up to a gun at an army base and you see an artillery shell there and you say, well, I think I'll just play a tune on this artillery shell with a hammer, there's a good chance it goes off and it'll kill you. People don't do things like that. Mm-hmm. So if you treat it with respect. So I don't want to give any impression that radiation isn't dangerous. A lot of radiation handled incorrectly is dangerous. But the gamma radiation, for example, when you get that in small doses in nuclear medicine, you put a particular chemical into a person, and that chemical is designed to, say, go to a cancer in the liver, for argument's sake. The chemical will go there. You attach to it a radioactive atom, and it carries it there. You give the radioactive injection to somebody, you wait a short while and you use a scanner and you can see the radiation incredibly clearly coming out. So you can identify the cancers with great precision. Nuclear medicine is by far the best way to detect cancer. It works incredibly well and you'll detect it long before any other method. Things like breast cancer in women, prostate cancer in men, and many other cancers, if you detect them early, you can save the patient's life. There's also others, now theranostics, which is going from the diagnostics into the therapeutic, which uses, for example, the alphas. You take those atoms, you try and park them right next to the cancer, and it's like short-range artillery. It'll kill the cancer cells from the inside. Here in Pretoria, we've done certain experiments, and we've cured cancer patients by using that type of approach to theranostics. That will come about in the future. It's not generally available now. But there's different types of radiation. The nuclear specialists know what they're doing, and people must have faith in nuclear professionals and not panic because they read something about radiation. Yes, it'll last a long time. But again, if you put it in the proper casks, containers, and you store it in the right place, it doesn't matter. It's not going to harm you. So this argument that people say it's going to stay radioactive for 10,000 years or 100,000 years, don't go near it, that's wrong. In fact, arsenic will stay poisonous forever.
So how do they dispose of radioactive waste now from power plants around the world?
Well, what you do is you put it underwater or you bury it. And in fact, the high-level waste, which is spent fuel coming out of a nuclear reactor, the spent fuel is worth more money than gold per kilogram. So nobody throws it away. In the very early days, some nuclear stuff was like disposed of in a permanent way, so to speak. And it was found out that was a mistake. You shouldn't do that. But I'm going back decades now. So now there's a principle that with nuclear waste, you don't throw it away. You go and store it. So if you ever change your mind in the future, you just pick it up. South Africa has got one of the oldest nuclear waste repositories in the world. It's been running for over 35 years now. And there the waste is stored. You put it there, every single barrel with anything in it is numbered and information is stored. At any time, if somebody says, have a look at the barrel that was put down in 1978 containing this and that from that place, you can go and find that particular barrel and dig it up and move it. Mm-hmm. So this idea that somehow the radioactive stuff is thrown out into the bush or something and it's all over the place and it's contaminated is not true. And if future generations want to go and build a high-rise apartment on top of the nuclear waste repository or something, all you do is change your mind, pick it all up and take it somewhere else. It's not an irreversible decision.
And it's a very small amount, isn't it, in comparison with the waste from fossil fuels?
Absolutely. In the case of the nuclear power station near Cape Town, it's a 2,000 megawatt power station. Now, if that power station was run on coal, it would use 6 trainloads of coal every day. But in fact, it uses 1 single truckload of nuclear fuel every year. That's all.
I want to go back, Kelvin, to where you said the waste is worth more than gold, which is actually true because it's processed uranium and it can be reprocessed to make fuel at a lower cost. Unfortunately, President Carter, back in his time as president, he outlawed the reprocessing of nuclear waste for new fuel. And although he studied nuclear engineering at the Naval Academy, he obviously didn't get very good grades because he thought that in the reprocessing, you would produce weapon-grade plutonium, which was absolutely untrue. Now, President Reagan overturned Carter's ruling in 1992, but the reprocessing industry in the United States had basically shut down and they never made a comeback. I would assume in other countries they are doing some reprocessing of fuel, which essentially makes that fuel less expensive than the initial mining of the uranium and the concentration into more U-235.
Well, that is the case, but reprocessing, you can divert plutonium and you can make weapons if you want to, but that's not breaking the rules and it's bad behavior. Now, any country that decides it wants to be part of the gentleman's nuclear club and joins up with the International Atomic Energy Agency and so on, just like if you're making pharmaceuticals or if you're making anything else, you agree what are the rules of the game. Those countries that want to break the rules of the game, like North Korea or something, must suffer the consequences if other people decide that they've become dangerous and therefore have to be handled in a heavy-handed manner. So the idea that you can make weapons out of diverting something or other really is a wrong argument to use to stop it being done. There's very little reprocessing that takes place at the moment because it's much easier to use the enriched uranium that comes from uranium plants and so on. So there isn't much done for that's one of the reasons. But the as you correctly say, the material in it is very, very valuable because you can take out the uranium that hasn't been used and use it later. You can take out plutonium and there are other things that are valuable. You mentioned President Carter, and he's a bit of a sensitive point with me, because we've got another nuclear reactor near Pretoria called the Safari reactor. It is an American design, and we were buying fuel from the United States at the time of Carter, and a whole load of fuel had been manufactured in the U.S. and was ready to deliver to South Africa, and Carter stepped in and stopped the delivery of the fuel. And that would imply that our reactor here would close down. That's the one that's used now to produce the nuclear medicine. I was one of a group of 11 scientists called in. I was a very junior scientist at the time and said, right, the South African government and in secret had said, we have to make our own fuel if this is what the Americans have done to us. So what we did is we rushed in a great secret, we produced our own fuel. Not only did we do that, but we discovered how to do the uranium enrichment so well that we were able to go all the way to nuclear weapons by ourselves if we wanted to. So, which is what happened at the time. South Africa did produce nuclear weapons. They did make some bombs. And then when the president at the time came in, F.W. de Klerk, he said, this is not the way. Stop it. So we stopped the weapons program, announced it to the world, dismantled all the weapons, destroyed them, and became the first country in the world to admit that nuclear weapons had been made and to destroy them in public. And we have then become very, very well behaved. The Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency a few years ago, face to face with me, said, you South Africans are so well behaved that if everybody was like you, I wouldn't have any problems in my job. Jimmy Carter, by the way, not only did he keep the fuel, there was a contract, but he kept all the money because we paid in advance. He wouldn't give us our money back and he didn't give us the fuel either. And for some decades, it was like that. And only when Nelson Mandela became president, he was able to go to the U.S. authorities and say, listen, fellows, Carter kept the fuel and the money. I think you should give us our money back. Only then did we get the money back. So that left a rather bitter taste in the mouth, you see. So
yeah,
I'm not a fan of Carter related to nuclear.
The record will show that Jimmy Carter graduated the U.S. Naval Academy, majoring in nuclear engineering. He came out either bottom of his class or three places from the bottom. He a nice, well-intended fellow, but not bright at all. And in this particular case, he was not even being honest with the South African government.
Yeah, well, what he did is he induced us to go and develop the nuclear fuel ourselves and to develop nuclear weapons. Had he not done that, we probably would never have done that.
Now,
these actions did.
You mentioned that you export nuclear medicine from South Africa. Could you explain how you go about doing that?
Well, it's made in the nuclear reactor, but because it has a limited lifetime of only a few days, you have to move it very quickly. Now, in fact, the United States is a very big customer of ours. So we export very, very many millions of dollars worth of medicine to the United States. It comes out of the reactor here near Pretoria. It's then raced to the airport. There's all sorts of checks along the way. You can imagine you can't put it in a container without being checked and sealed and signed and so on. It's raced to the airport, then from there it's flown out. We export to more than 60 countries, going as far as Argentina. We go Turkey, the Far East, United States, Europe, all over. And then it lands in Rio for argument's sake, and there's somebody there to meet it. And we say we'll inject anybody in the world in under 36 hours from it coming out of the reactor here. and the exports that take place 2 to 3 times a day, every day of the year, including days like Christmas and so on. And this is the only reactor in the world that runs continuously producing life-saving medicine. In fact, every 3 seconds, somebody somewhere in the world is injected with nuclear medicine from here, and every 3 hours, somebody's life is saved as a result of it. So there's huge benefit from nuclear. And people mm-hmm. must understand how good it is for mankind and stop thinking of nuclear as a bad and dangerous thing and have in your life.
Mm-hmm. You know, years ago, I remember reading that if all of my electricity was generated by nuclear for my entire life, that the amount of radioactive high-level waste would be about the equivalent of the size of a golf ball. Is that about right?
Well, I say a couple of soft drink cans. The golf ball is probably right, depending on the enrichment of the uranium you're talking about. But certainly if you took 2 soft drink cans of uranium, that would give you all the energy you want for your lifetime. So in principle, everybody, when they're born, they could say, here are your 2 cans or 2 baseballs, if you like. You American guys know what a baseball looks like. Here's 2 baseballs of uranium. That's yours. And the day you die, they throw them in your coffin as well and say, take them with you. Which obviously, you know, wow. Do that. I say that as a joke. But you're quite right. That's all it is. As against something like coal, for example, which results in a mountain of ash and others as well. All the unsolved waste problem of wind and solar. You know, we keep hearing people talk about the unsolved nuclear waste. There's no unsolved nuclear waste problem. But boy, is there an unsolved solar and wind problem. Those solar panels have all got to be got rid of. They've got cadmium in them, they've got arsenic in them and so on. The wind turbine blades, you cannot dispose of those blades easily. They will get cut up. They're digging holes in the ground and burying them. There's going to be a much bigger problem getting rid of old solar panels and old turbine blades and the concrete bases and so on that the turbine's on than there ever will be on getting rid of spent fuel out of a nuclear reactor. That's easy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, no discussion about nuclear, of course, would be complete without at least talking about whether what happened at Chernobyl in the Ukraine, could that happen in the Western world?
No, not really at all. And the reason is the difference in policy of the countries. At the time, that was the Soviet Union. There was no mechanism to have like a free press. There was the whole hierarchical situation of the Soviet Union. They built those reactors. They were built on what is known as a positive void coefficient as well, whereas in the West, they build them on what's called a negative void coefficient. And that meant, in effect, that if something started to go wrong with one of those reactors, it tended to accelerate itself. Whereas a Western-type reactor, if something went wrong, it would tend to shut itself down, and you'd have to fan it, so to speak. You know, if you're having, we call it a braai, you guys call it a barbecue. You know what it's like when the barbecue is not heating up and you stand there with a newspaper or something fanning the barbecue. That's what you have to do with Western reactors. So the Soviet scientists at the time designed that reactor, and it was a poor design. The Soviets knew about it. After a couple of years, the Soviet scientists, I've been to Russia a number of times. I've spoken to these Soviet scientists. I was honored by being invited to be guest speaker at their nuclear research center of Dubna. Great experience going there to this place, seeing all the great Soviet and Russian scientists' photographs on the wall where I spoke. But they knew there were things going wrong. They were telling their people at the time, there's something wrong. We shouldn't be running this. And the authorities said, keep quiet, do your job, make electricity. Mm-hmm. Then they decided to do a test to test certain safety features and whatever. So the test was supposed to happen in the daytime, but they didn't manage to do it. The daytime team went home, and effectively the B team was on duty at night. And they said, right, do the test at night. They said, we shouldn't be doing this. But there was nobody prepared to override the instruction they'd been given, because nobody wanted to phone to higher authority, so we shouldn't be doing this with the B team. And it started to go wrong. And the nature of the reactor was that it was difficult to stop. And then also, at that time, Soviet policy was they didn't need to have a containment vessel around the reactor. All Western reactors are built with a containment vessel, that if there's serious leakage inside, it's contained within this barrier that one of you fellows mentioned earlier, that if a Boeing flies into it, it'll bounce off, so to speak, it's not going to destroy it. They didn't have that. So when the thing started to go wrong, it had also had graphite in it as a moderator, which most reactors in the West don't do. They use water and other means. That thing caught fire like a big barbecue. and it was the burning graphite and all the crud that was coming off. It was radioactive smoke and muck going up into the sky. It wasn't a nuclear explosion in any sense. It was just a big nuclear bonfire. And then, of course, they had brave firemen that went in and brave first responders that went in to try and quell the blaze and so on. And it was a number of those fellows that were killed. The total number of people dying from radiation at Chernobyl was less than 60. Not this thousands and thousands and whatever that the anti-nuclear people tend to always come up with. So even with a disaster like that, the death toll was sad, but still relatively small.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Well, Calvin, I'd like to move slightly to another subject that I know is on the minds of all our listeners, and that's fusion energy. I was at Princeton when Albert Einstein was there, and I like to joke that I had a nodding acquaintance with him, which is true. We would pass on the streets frequently and nod. We never chatted, but we knew each other. And in 1955, Albert Einstein predicted that we would have fusion energy, which he felt was safer than fission, within 50 years. And of course, 50 years later, they were still saying that we were 50 years away from fusion. I do not think that fusion energy will ever be commercial. I've written widely about it. What is your opinion of any advantages or possibilities that fusion will ever come to be in spite of the billions and billions of dollars that have been spent trying to create a tiny amount of fusion energy?
I think we'll get fusion energy right eventually, but not tomorrow. We might have a breakthrough and find something starts to work in the next decade, but the chances are it's decades away. So for the lifetimes of most people on the planet right now, I don't think they're going to see a financially viable fusion, but you never know. But it's worth it to work on it. But for the immediate future, fusion is not going to solve our electricity problems. What we need is conventional fission energy from normal-sized nuclear reactors, so to speak, these 1,000-megawatt reactors, but also much smaller reactors. The small modular reactors are only 100 megawatts, and any country can get one of those. It's not limited to the big, powerful countries only, so nuclear is available to everybody.
So it sounds like that's a good source of power for Africa.
Absolutely. Every single African country can go nuclear. In fact, already about a dozen African countries have formally told the International Atomic Energy Agency that they are following a nuclear path, and many have started with all the legislation and getting nuclear institutions going and so on. And the answer is these 100 megawatt reactors that you can put 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 together on a site if you want to. So it's much cheaper. You can make a decision to go for 100, then add as it goes. Also, the sizes of the countries here are huge in comparison to Europe. So you can take a 100 megawatt reactor to where you have, say, a mining town. You can put it there. It doesn't have to be near any source of cooling water. It doesn't have to be connected to a national grid. It can be completely independent. The opportunities are fantastic to have smaller reactors and even smaller than that, down to 10 megawatts and down to 1 megawatt units that can drive independent units like cargo ships as well and things like that. So I just see nuclear will be running everything in decades to come and in the future.
Because when you normally think of a nuclear station, you think of huge cooling towers and access to main big bodies of water, but you're saying it's not necessary with these small reactors.
Not at all. In fact, South Africa started developing a small modular reactor at the end of the 1990s, and it was called the Pebble Bed Modular Reactor. It was gas-cooled with helium, and deliberately because we don't have water in South Africa very much. We're rather arid country, so we said, let's build a small reactor that doesn't need water. So it was helium-cooled. Since then, another one, a derivative of that, has been designed here in Pretoria called the HTMR-100. It is cheaper and faster to bring to market, and it will be ready soon for deployment. And it's that type of reactor that could be the answer to every African country and many others. You can put one down, and when you need another 100, you add it, another 100, and so on. So it's very easy to go nuclear that route. You don't have to have an ocean or a big lake, and you don't have to go for 2,000 megawatts at a shot or 3,000 or 4,000 megawatts. So there's all sorts of possibilities for anybody to look towards nuclear as a future.
Mm-hmm. And are the environmental groups resisting these small modular reactors too?
Absolutely. And as I said earlier, they're resisting because they don't want the electricity. You know, they want to be dependent on solar and wind, and solar there's none at night, and wind there isn't any when the wind doesn't blow. So it's a self-limiting system. And to my mind, that is what's behind it. I say, well, you want a simple lifestyle. If you want a simple lifestyle like that, go back to the 300 years. That's the lifestyle that's lived then. You relied on the sun and the wind and so on and so forth. And if you want to turn back the clock and go back to wooden ships, ox wagons, and cooking fire, your dinner over an open fire and so on, that's the lifestyle. I don't think the average person wants to do that. So the answer is go for something nice and clean like nuclear power, which is green, cheap, safe. It's the answer for mankind, everybody.
Exactly. What about the mining of uranium? I mean, a lot of your environmentalists will tell us that this is horrible for the environment, but is that really true with modern uranium mining techniques?
I don't believe so. You know, in fact, in South Africa, uranium comes largely out of the gold mines. It comes as a byproduct of gold production. The gold mining has done very, very well here. So obviously any mining is going to produce some dust and so on, but like with any industry, if you do it responsibly, and here it is done like that, there's very strict health and safety regulations. You can't have dust blowing all over the place in unhealthy conditions. Mm-hmm. To my mind, working in a well-run mine is no different to working in many types of factories. So this story about uranium mining being a problem, I don't believe that at all. Mining is very professionally handled by the people who do it properly.
Wow, it sounds great.
I would like to end and try to talk you, Kelvin, into writing a brief article that I'd like to co-author with you on smaller nuclear plants. I mean, I think that people don't understand the safety of the smaller plants and how they could still be a future energy source here in the United States while the big plants are failing economically. I think that is an area that our listeners are not clear on, the modular plant that can be our future even as the big plants fail. So if you would write a brief article about your knowledge and what you see going on in South Africa, I'd like to work on it and publish it here, because I think it's a subject that very few people understand. They've maybe heard of it, but they don't know why it's different, why it's safer, why it's economical. So I'd like to work with you on that in the future, Kelvin.
We'd very much like to do it. And I think there's huge market for it in the big countries as well. I know there's a lot of interest in the United States. There was a lot of interest 20 years ago from Canada in using the South African pebble bed modular reactor in Canada. Canada's going very much in the direction of small modular reactors. Many other countries are. It's really erupting as a source of power for the future. So you can put them wherever you like. There's a place for big reactors. There's also a place for small reactors doing jobs in specific places in a different manner. There's scope for all of them.
Wow, that's a great way to end. Very optimistic and sounds very realistic for a future nuclear renaissance with small modular reactors. So this is Dr. Jay Lair and Tom Harris with our guest, nuclear physicist Dr. Kelvin Kem, signing out from the other side of the story.